Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, NPR's David Folkenflik on media coverage of Ebola.
But first, the news today on Ebola. President Obama has postponed his travel plans to convene a meeting this afternoon with his cabinet members on the government's response to Ebola. This comes, of course, as that second Dallas healthcare worker has tested positive for Ebola. And we got news today that she traveled on a Frontier Airlines flight from Cleveland to Dallas just 2 days ago, one day before the diagnosis. Dwali Saikautau is a reporter with KERA in Dallas. She's been following the story. Dwali, the CDC has been giving some more information today. What more are we learning?
Well, we've just learned that they are going to move this second nurse to Emory. That's where two of the Americans who had contracted Ebola, were moved there and recovered. So that's the hope.
And they're transferring that patient to Atlanta, but not the other one, not Nina Pham.
That we haven't heard yet, and it's not clear why they're moving this patient different from Nina Pham. We understand that Nina Pham is improving. Her condition is improving. This particular person, whose name has not been identified, is a female nurse in her mid-20s, and we don't know exactly what her actual condition is, only that she had a fever and was isolated within 90 minutes.
But we are hearing that she did care for or have some contact with Thomas Eric Duncan in the early days before they had confirmed that he had Ebola, right?
That's right. Dr. Frieden says that, the first few days is the highest risk period, and both those nurses worked during that time. So, it's still unclear how these nurses were infected, and that investigation is ongoing.
And yet this second nurse, even knowing that she had come in contact with Thomas Eric Duncan and then later that he had been diagnosed with Ebola, went and took this flight. A lot of people asking a lot of questions about that. In fact, the CDC is saying today the patient should not have traveled and that no one now who is being actively monitored will be allowed to travel. Tell us more about the what we know about this flight that this nurse took just 2 days ago.
Yes. Obviously, this is a very fast-moving situation. Texas health officials only confirmed the Ebola symptoms of this second nurse around midnight. Within hours, city, county hospital officials were going into the neighborhood where this person lives. And now this news that this nurse traveled from Cleveland to Dallas. Obviously, there's concern about the time when she took the evening flight to when she reported the fever. So CDC and Frontier Airlines is asking that all 132 passengers on flight 1143 from Cleveland to Dallas, that they should call an 800 number. And that's the idea there is to determine the risk of contracting the disease and, who may have been exposed to this.
And at this morning's press conference, the Dallas mayor, Mike Rawlings, was asked about how people at the apartment complex where this latest healthcare worker victim, person who has been tested positive for Ebola lives, how the people in that apartment complex were notified. Let's listen to what he said.
I personally was at the apartment complex this morning. Each apartment in their complex was, the door was knocked on, and we talked to as many people that came to the door as possible.
Dwali, do we know more about how the city is handling the cleanup of her apartment?
Well, at this point, we know that phase one is taking place, and that's basically the common areas outside her apartment and in the apartment complex. Phase two is when they bring in a contract approved a group of hazmat people who will actually go inside the apartment and remove what they need to, and as well as go into the remove the car. So there's a lot of things happening. People are just finding out about this news, and obviously neighbors have been told about this even before the 7 a.m. briefing.
And what about the other 75 health workers who are being monitored. What do we know about their whereabouts and how that monitoring is taking place?
Well, when asked about the other 75 healthcare workers being monitored, a Dallas County official, Judge Clay Jenkins, said those workers are employed, but they are not working. He also said that facilities are being set up for people who want to be away from their families. They can do that. But the bottom line is that there is actually no protective order on these individuals. So if, for example, they decide that they want to travel, they want to move about, it's anybody's guess about where people are traveling.
And meantime, we've been hearing your reports today about how nurses are saying that they were not adequately trained. They didn't have the adequate protective gear in place to deal with Thomas Eric Duncan or to deal with any Ebola case that may come up. Dr. Daniel Varga, the chief clinical officer for the Texas Health Resources, that's the hospital system that operates Texas Health Presbyterian, spoke to that. Let's hear what he had to say at today's press conference.
I don't think we have a systematic institutional problem. I think the biggest challenge we have right now is obviously first and foremost the care of the two patients that we have and the ongoing screening of folks in the community.
So what about that, Dwali, the idea of doing more to support the hospital staff?
Well, again, this is really about infection control. And so training, education, obviously the unions are concerned about what kind of training their nurses and doctors have received. A lot of what we're hearing are secondary or third reports from people. So we don't yet know directly from nurses themselves about what they've actually been given in terms of training or education. We do know that Dr. Frieden has said over and over again, the CDC's top health chief has said that they are working to actually get as much information out there to every hospital in the country. And obviously that, Dallas is a top priority.
All right. Dwali Saikautau, reporter with KERA in Dallas on the fast-moving situation there. Dwali, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, some of the first horrific images of Ebola in West Africa came to the U.S. from NBC's chief medical editor, Dr. Nancy Snyderman. She and her crew traveled to Liberia to document the disease. And here's just a moment from her reporting last month.
Today we watched as a 17-year-old girl named Jane was brought to Redemption Hospital and left in a wheelbarrow looking near death.
Where are you going?
But seconds later, she bolted up and tried to run away. She was stopped by her mother, who walked her back toward hospital staff who were dressed in their protective equipment.
Then came the news that her freelance cameraman, Ashoka Mukpo of Rhode Island, contracted Ebola. He's at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. Snyderman and the rest of the crew flew to the U.S. and went into voluntary quarantine. But then she was seen in Princeton, New Jersey. NPR's media guru David Folkenflik has some thoughts on that story and the media coverage in general. And David, just remind us, she was seen in public and this caused a firestorm.
Well, she was seen in public, and it was picked up actually in the comments section of an article a bit about Snyderman on a local news blog written by a journalist there in Princeton, New Jersey. She had been seen waiting in a car, apparently sunglasses on, hair pulled back, for some takeout from a local grill with a male companion, presumably a friend or her husband. And people said, well, look, if she's supposedly voluntarily quarantined, what is she doing going out? What is she doing getting takeout? And it seemed like a fairly mundane question, but in a sense, it was kind of citizen journalism, fact-checking and saying, what the heck is she doing out of voluntary quarantine?
Well, it's just part of the whole, what is supposed to happen here? And here's Rosie Perez on ABC's The View.
Listen, whether she knows she's infected or not, you know, you just don't do that. You don't put fear into the public when you're a public figure.
So Rosie Perez among those saying it's symbolic, you know, to see somebody who was supposed to be quarantined out. But look, you know, there are people risking their lives to do reporting in West Africa. She did. NPR's Ophabia Quistark and Jason Bobie and Greg Warner. Mm-hmm. You hesitate to be critical of somebody who did put their own life at risk. And she is a doctor. She knows she has no symptoms. Presumably she's taking her. She said she was taking her temperature. So, I mean, your thoughts, this story as a symbol.
Well, look, you know, she's making the argument she's not contagious. I want to read briefly from the statement that she made in a kind of qualified contrition. She said, while under voluntary quarantine guidelines, which called for our team to avoid public content for 21 days, members of our group violated those guidelines and understand our quarantine is now mandatory. As a health professional, she goes on, I know that we have no symptoms and pose no risk to the public, but I am deeply sorry for the concerns this episode caused. I think there are a number of problems about this. One of the problems about the statement is she doesn't take any personal responsibility. Secondly, she has gone to West Africa, as you say, and shown some real courage in covering this incredibly important but incredibly fear-inducing story. She has brought some real medical knowledge to it, but she's also talked about the need to be under what she originally went under was a voluntary quarantine, under what she and NBC presented as a surplus of caution. And yet she violated that because she thought she could get away with it. And it's as though there are a different set of rules if you're a celebrity network medical correspondent than if you're the average person, a nurse who might have incidentally come into contact with things. And I think so many people don't believe yet the medical truth presented, or at least the research presented by our top health officials, that this can't be caught through air contact and that it's not contagious if you're not showing symptoms and a fever of some sort, that, you know, she really violated sort of a sense of trust between herself and the audience in doing that.
Well, it's becoming apparent that the media has a huge responsibility here. We're going to bring you back to talk more about that. But in the minute we have, there was a poll from Rutgers in New Jersey that showed that people in New Jersey, this is fascinating, those who said they were following the outbreak news the most had the most inaccurate information about it. People paying a lot of attention were twice as likely to believe that there's an effective medicine to treat it, for instance. Just your sense, and we only have about a minute, but what this says about media coverage?
Well, what I'd say is a couple of things. I think there's been a lot of tremendously good coverage on NPR, in the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal, in the Dallas Morning News. It really brings some real rigor to what's both a local and international story for them down there. And at the same time, the tenor of coverage has been so overwhelmingly panic-inducing. There have been so many echoes, as our colleague Don Gagne has noted, of these thriller movies that are, in a sense, horror movies, things like Outbreak, that play into our greatest fears, that I think the relentlessness of the coverage and the tenor of the fear of what is still, in many ways, an unknown disease to Americans, and what is in always a very deadly disease if contracted, has contributed to a lot of concerns and to a lot of people misimpressions about how it spreads.
Something that's impossible to get until there are symptoms and then it's virulent. Tough to cover. David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Today, for the first time since February, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped below 16,000. And at one point this morning, the S&P 500 was at its lowest point of the year. That comes with a sharp drop this week in oil prices. So what is happening in financial markets? Joining us is Julie Nieman, financial analyst with Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Julie, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's going on?
Well, probably the biggest thing, we have to keep a little balance here. This happens most years. September and October, the market falls with the leaves. Now, it didn't happen last year, so of course, you know, investors have completely forgotten that this didn't happen. What we're looking at, though, there are a lot of factors that are going on right now that cause all of this to happen. One of the biggest thing is light trading volume, punctuated by points of total panic and heavy trading. You've got seasonal factors. Fund managers at the end of the year are giving facials to their portfolios so that they look better. They sell the stocks that look like warts on the portfolio, and they buy the ones that look like beauty marks. The mutual funds are going to be distributing their big capital gains. Some years, like 2008 through 11, it was ugly, no gains. This year, they're going to be big ones, and they're going to be back and big. Analysts, they're perpetually optimistic and hopeful. Three-quarters worth of earnings are in now. They've reported. Reality sets in that maybe their full year's estimates just might not be met. They start dropping their estimates, and that's a company with a lot of fog about why the target won't be hit, and you're going to see selling. Then on top of that, you've got tax selling going on. It used to be December. Now it's September and October. So portfolios get cleaned out for that purpose.
So you're saying basically that, Julie, that they are this is cyclical. This is not there's nothing bigger going on here, that you're not worried about global demand being down and oil prices dropping?
You've got a whole list of economic worries that are always there. The big thing is this going to kill the economy? And no, it's not. In fact, oil dropping is an absolute boom to our economy. You've got about 7% of everybody's disposable income going into the gas tank. Right now, you're looking at that price going way down. That's going to be available to put into the shopping carts instead of the gas tank. 70% of our economy is run by consumers. We're going to see a very respectable Christmas because people are going to have more money to spend.
All right,
that really pushes it ahead.
Well, although some people say, you know, the reason that those oil prices are dropping is because we're going to have lower demand perhaps coming from Europe and China. So some things to watch out for. But Julie Nieman there making us at least feel a little better about some big drops this week in the stock market. Julie Nieman of Smithmore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
And as the stock market slides downward, let's talk about something going in the other direction. Hotel fees. The lodging industry has been applying hidden and sometimes not so hidden fees for years. And this year, the revenue from those fees and surcharges hit a new high. That's according to our next guest, Bjorn Hansen, a professor at the Center for Hospitality, Tourism and Sports Management at New York University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you did a recent study on how these hidden hotel fees are skyrocketing. What did you find?
Well, we'll have another record this year in 2014 of about $2.25 billion collected by the U.S. lodging industry in fees and surcharges. Some people call them hidden. They're sometimes hard to find, not hidden. So I think maybe the word surprise sometimes is a more appropriate way to refer to them.
And tell us what some of them are.
Well, some of the newest ones are an early check-in fee. So if a hotel has a check-in time of 3 o'clock and a guest arrives at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, traditionally, if a room were available, the room might be assigned to the guest. In some locations, and Las Vegas is where this is happening more than anywhere else, the guest is given an option of being assigned a room before check-in time, but there might be a fee of something like $30. Another recent one is a charge for unattended surface parking. So this would be for a suburban-type hotel, open parking. Many hotels are now installing gates and charging for parking. Again, it's unattended. In the past, it wasn't a charge, but a new fee or surcharge.
Well, and the one that I see all the time that I can't believe is this resort fee, where they charge you $25 a day or more for things that you probably get anyway for free.
Right. So that's one that's really become ubiquitous in the U.S. resort industry. And as you said, the fee is $25 a day or more. There are some resorts charging $60 per guest per day. Hmm. So that can be a very big source of revenue.
And why not just include that in the cost of the room?
Well, there are two primary reasons, or probably hundreds of them. But the two primary reasons are, first of all, guests these days can use the internet and research and compare rates so easily. And a very small difference in room rate does shift market share. In my research for business travelers, $2 difference in the room rate will shift share. So if one hotel includes fees and surcharges and one doesn't, it might actually lose business because of the comparison of rates. The second is, and this is a kind of a subtle issue, but in so many municipalities now, there is an occupancy tax, sometimes called a bed tax, and that's calculated on room revenue only, not other charges. So in fact, if there were a $60 extra charge included in the room rate instead of being separate, that would now be subject to that additional tax.
But what you're saying is when I'm looking on Kayak or anywhere else, the rate that I'm seeing while I'm sitting there comparing, and even a $2 difference might change what I decide to do, I'm not getting the full picture, because as soon as I go to that hotel, even if I've paid $200 a night for it, I might have to pay another $25 a day that I won't even find out about till after I've made the reservation.
Right. Now, the hotel industry has become much better at disclosing that specific charge. There are some others as well. And if it's a reservation made, say, through the 800 number, there's a script that the reservationist will read. If it's an electronic place reservation, they'll be in fairly large type, not the fine print that sometimes it's referred to.
But it won't be included in the charge that I pay right up front.
Right. So it'll be added on. And just as you said, you may not find out about it unless you're reading all of the fine print or make the reservation on the telephone until you arrive at the hotel. And that's why I think the word surprise sometimes is the right word instead of maybe hidden for these kinds of fees and surcharges.
Can you tell the hotel that you don't want the resort fee, that you don't want to get the amenities that they would be giving you, and therefore you don't want to pay the fee?
For the specific situation of a resort fee, that would be very unusual that it could be waived. Others, it really is important to try to negotiate up front. So the best thing to do is to ask at the time of reservation, will there be any automatic fees and surcharges, to note the name of that reservation representative or his or her ID number, and then the guest has a really good argument when the time comes to say, no, wait a minute, when I made that reservation, I asked and was told there were no automatic fees and surcharges, therefore this is unfair.
Why did this happen? We know in the airline business that they were not doing very well, especially after 9/11, and needed to find ways to make up some more revenue. So they started adding fees here and there. And these days, I think they make more money on their fees, more profit on their fees than they do on selling tickets. But what about hotels? Why did they need to do it?
Well, the first report I did on hotel fees and surcharges was in 1997, and that was a resort fee I actually found out about. And it was implemented by one of the hotel companies with some success. Word got around, and therefore it was just an extra source of revenue. Then in 2000, when we had an energy shortage, some hotels started charging an energy surcharge because their costs were higher. And although that one was more unpopular actually than the resort fees, it still was accepted more than maybe people thought it would be.
That's Bjorn Hansen, a professor at the Center for Hospitality, Tourism, and Sports Management at New York University, talking with us about some of these new, maybe not so new in some cases, hotel fees. Bjorn, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And starting today, shoppers at around 400 Whole Foods markets across this country and in Canada will see a sustainability rating on some of their produce and flowers. Broccoli, for instance, might be rated good, better, or best based on water use, pesticide, waste management, and the treatment of farm workers. This comes after a plan earlier this month from Walmart to increase that company's sustainability. CNN's Maggie Lake is here. And Maggie, is it fair to say that what Whole Foods is doing is in direct response to competition?
I think it is, Robin. Great to be with you. I mean, I think that that Whole Foods is trying to regain the lead, really, as the health-conscious environmental grocer. And in many ways, they've been a victim of their own success. I actually went to Austin and met with John Mackey, the CEO, about 10 years ago. And if you remember at the time, there were a lot of people skeptical about whether consumers would really seek out organic food and locally sourced food in mass market. And Whole Foods proved that they would. And once that started happening, you've really seen your local supermarkets. I'm sure you've seen the signs about locally sourced and the Walmart, those giants completely jumping on that organic movement. And that's taken share away from Whole Foods. So I think this is them trying to take the lead again and really stand out from all that competition.
Well, so Whole Foods might have raised all boats, if you will, towards sustainability and better foods. But it also has its critics who say this huge company replace small, sustainable local growers. And we remember the 60 Minutes piece. It showed the company growing swaths of food and then trucking it across country. Mm-hmm. We spoke to Matt Rogers at Whole Foods today. He worked on developing this new rating system. And he told us Whole Foods is looking at the use of fuels and fertilizers at the farm level, but they won't be tracking trucking.
Tracking different ratings based on destination and origin was not something that we wanted to try to accomplish while we're doing so much else at the farm level right now. So it's certainly something we'll look at in the future.
So, Maggie, is Whole Foods maybe, you know, overlooking the thing that a giant store like Whole Foods is most responsible for, the trucking?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that, Robin. I mean, it's a key part of that story. But I think that it seems like Whole Foods trying to exert the influence where they know they can. You've got to start someplace, right? So if you're going to expand it, they really have created a market for a lot of these local farms, organic farms. There are some that exist solely because Whole Foods is in the market as a major supplier. So if they say to them, listen, we're changing the rules again, we're going to have this other level, and if you don't play, we're not going to buy for you. A lot of consumer advocates and people who watch this space do believe that that pressure coming from the private sector, right, the private company as opposed to the government, is what can move the needle. And I think that at least in that respect, they're starting where they think they have the most power. Do they want to tackle that? I'm sure if you spoke to them, you probably said they do, and certainly advocates want them to. But it is at least a step in the right direction.
Well, but now they have to. A poor farmer from Connecticut told the New York Times that his farm has been growing fruit since the 1700s, and now he's being asked how many earthworms he has in the soil. I mean, farmers now have to do extra work.
They certainly do. And any time you have new rules to come into play, no matter what the business, the first thing, especially small businesses, the first thing they ask is, what am I going to have to do? Am I going to have to do more work? And more importantly, is it going to cost me money? And when you're talking about farms, I was just out at a family farm for a different story in New York State. And this is the definition of small business. It was a family-owned farm. The matriarch was running the cash register, giving school kids group tours, and worrying about billing, which was, by the way, done on paper. So it's going to be a challenge. But I would think that farms doing this anyway, these practices anyway, it'll give them a chance to differentiate themselves as well and get the marketing out in a way that they could never afford.
That's CNN's Maggie Lake as Whole Foods announced new ratings on about half of its produce and flowers in 400 of its stores. Maggie, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. More than 500,000 homeowners and businesses around the country have put solar panels on their rooftops, and the pace has picked up dramatically. More sun-absorbing systems have been installed in the last 3 years than during the 30 prior years combined. That's according to the Solar Energy Industries Association. Renewable systems are, for the most part, still hooked up to the grid, and now utilities are saying individual energy producers are costing them more than the energy that they contribute to that grid through their panels. Utilities in 40 states are figuring out how to manage this growing industry, and some are looking to cut back on solar incentives. That includes Wisconsin, where solar represents less than 1% of that state's energy mix. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WUWM's Susan Bentz reports.
Milwaukee is not known as the Windy City. That title belongs to our neighbor to the south. But for the last few months, a swirl of volatile air has engulfed the Wisconsin city, starting at City Hall.
To me, this issue is one of the most important issues facing the people in the Milwaukeeland area.
Alderman Tony Zielinski is upset with We Energies. The local utility plans to pay solar customers less for the extra energy they produce, dropping the rate from 14 cents to roughly 3 cents per kilowatt hour. It also wants to add a surcharge called a demand fee that could add up to nearly $200 annually for the average solar owner.
It's very important that we promote solar power and renewable energy. And what We Energies is doing is putting us back.
Right now, we are at a crossing point. We are at a tipping point for our electric future here in the state of Wisconsin.
Renewable energy advocates took to a rain-spattered park outside We Energies' offices to protest the utility's plan. Dan Folkman lined the rooftop of his 1900-era duplex with solar panels last summer.
The fact that we could do that and get a reasonable return on that investment because there were what we thought policies and procedures and rates that were favorable towards going with solar. We thought we had a utility here in Milwaukee that was going to be with us all the way and have our back.
Wisconsin's Solar Trade Association brought Atlanta, Georgia resident Debbie Dooley to the state to try to broaden support to fight the utility's rate modifications. Dooley describes herself as a preacher's kid, a conservative who jumped into the renewable energy debate when Georgia Power attempted to limit solar, and when that failed, to slap a tax on solar producers.
And we fought that back.
The pint-sized dynamo has taken on the mantle of renewable energy as a symbol of consumers' right to choose, national security, and free market principles, all rolled into one.
We're not liberal. We're not conservative. We're Americans that believe in energy freedom. And it's like a big freight train rolling on the track, and it's keep moving forward, and this revolution is going to keep moving forward. And anyone that stands in the track will get run over.
Dooley might be a bit ahead of history, according to Granger Morgan.
I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and together with Jay Apt, I run the Carnegie Mellon Electricity Industry Center.
Morgan says utilities aren't going away anytime soon, and it's reasonable, he adds, for utilities to judiciously trim back paybacks to local solar producers and to add standby fees, two items that Wisconsin renewable advocates oppose.
If I have generation on my premises and I want to sell it to the power company has to worry a little bit about what happens if I suddenly can't provide power.
Morgan has been studying and encouraging students to reach for electrical innovation for nearly four decades at Carnegie Mellon. He says coming up with reliable, highly efficient, and non-polluting systems will be the future.
Power companies across the country are not too happy about doing this. On the other hand, they are not the most innovative entities in the world.
But utility spokesperson Jessica Williamson says We Energies has been supporting renewable innovations.
We've invested nearly $1 billion in renewable energy over the past decade. We operate the two largest wind farms in the state. We have 16 hydroelectric power plants. Our rate request actually does include a proposal to build $25 million solar development.
And Williamson adds, the utility is listening to customers. Just as the public comment period was about to end, We Energies announced existing solar customers would be able to operate under the current rate for 10 years.
And so they would see no change. They would have time to be able to get used to this change, work toward the change. It's about fairness.
Just say no.
Many of the several hundred people who showed up for a public hearing on Milwaukee's southwest side said they were not feeling We Energies' pledge to fairness. David Evans drove across town to share his concerns. He doesn't even own solar panels, but he worries about the utility's proposed increase to its monthly fixed rate from $9 to $16 for all residential customers. Evans doesn't know how he's going to handle the hike.
I unplug everything in the house when I leave except the refrigerator just to try to save. And then we all put on coats or sweatshirts and stuff like that, socks, and we just start to stay bundled with blankets and stuff. And then at night when everybody go to sleep, the temperature will go back down to about 50.
So how long have you been doing all of that?
I started doing this back in 2006 after my feelings got hurt by We Energy. So it kind of woke me up.
It's up to the Wisconsin Public Service Commissioners. There are three. Two named by Republican Governor Scott Walker, to decide. And stakeholders around the country, solar advocates and utilities alike, are watching Wisconsin closely. If commissioners here approve We Energy's request to charge solar owners for tapping into the sun's energy, more battles in other states will likely follow. For Here and Now, I'm Susan Bentz in Milwaukee.
This is Here and Now. The Kansas City Royals will make it to the World Series if they beat the Baltimore Orioles this afternoon in Game 4 of the American League Championship Series. And if that happens, or even if it doesn't, I'm sure our next guest will make a rhyme about it. Bill Littlefield is a voice you've probably heard many times on public radio. He's host of NPR's Only a Game and has written a new book out today of poems about sports. It's called Take Me Out. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, Jeremy, how's it going?
It's going well, and I just so that people can get a taste of what is in this book, why don't you read one and maybe start with swimming?
Okay. They're swimming in the ocean where the fish are sometimes scary, and once in a polluted lake I saw one that looked hairy. They're swimming in a river where the fish are likely quick, unless the river's dirty. If it is, they might be sick. And then they're swimming in a pool, which isn't so fantastic, for though they're bright and colorful, the fish therein are plastic.
Poet Bill Littlefield. Why a book of poetry, Bill?
Well, it's fun. I had written six other books, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to just put something together for the fun of it? And what fun I had had reading Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein and stuff like that to my kids when they were growing up. And I thought it might be fun to produce a book that parents and children would enjoy reading together, both for the sound of it and the jokes and the sense and just the delight.
And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking he must really love all of these sports or things about sports in order to write poems about them. Your love of sports, has it diminished at all over all these years? Because you've been doing Only a Game for now 21 years.
21 years is right. It's changed. I think I used to be, like a lot of people, a fan of particular teams. And I've become a fan of particular people that I meet and enjoy and respect. And I root for them no matter whose uniform they happen to be wearing.
Why did you end up getting into this in the first place, going all the way back to your days pre-Only a Game? You were on public radio talking about sports.
Yeah, and before that, I was writing about sports. I had a column for the Boston Ledger, now defunct. And the sports column was the thing that I got reinforced for doing. I wrote about politics, and I wrote about the school committee, and I did some movie reviews. But the sports column was the thing that the editor kept saying, do more of those. I like those. So that's what I ended up doing.
Why do you think that was? What was it about your sports column?
I think there was probably some energy and some sense of fun in it from the beginning. I invented a character named Deacon O'Day, and he was an observer of the sports scene. And even from those days, I was trying to write about stuff that maybe other sports writers were not so concerned with.
I know that on your first episode of Only a Game, you brought up an issue that has now become front and center in the news, and that is concussions in football. Of course, back then, nobody was talking about it.
Not as much, that's for sure. Most of the players who were suffering from dementia or had lost their businesses or in some cases lost their families were living in their cars, but nobody was talking about it. And many of them were so ashamed of what had happened or so confused by what had happened that they didn't know where to go for help. And certainly the NFL had not really set up any opportunity for them to get help from the league.
Well, what made you talk about it?
I read a few stories about some of these guys, and I thought, my goodness, here we are looking at what is becoming or has had, at, even at that point, already become the most popular sport in the country. And it seemed to me something of a scandal that they were so utterly contemptuous of the guys who'd gotten damaged, making the sport as big as it has become.
We're speaking with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game and author of a new book of poetry about sports. It's called Take Me Out. You're listening to Here and Now. And Bill, you talk about sports every week to people that, let's face it, aren't always the biggest sports fans because they're public radio listeners. They're interested in a lot of other things. Some of them are interested in sports, but I know it because every time we do a sports story on Here and Now, we get emails from people who say, why are you even covering this? How do you make something like sports interesting for people who it's not the first thing that they'd look at on the web, let's put it that way?
Well, first of all, a lot of people who listen to public radio are interested in sports. They compete in amateur athletics. They go to gyms. They ride bikes. They do all that fitness stuff. And so that's part of it. But the rest of it is really from the beginning, we've been looking for good stories to tell well. And they happened, in our case, to be stories that are set in sports. That was what got me involved in this from the beginning, as I thought an awful lot of the stories set in sports were not being told as well as they should be, and people weren't having as much fun or looking in as many directions as they might look, and it seemed to be an opportunity.
I want to go even further back than where we are right now to when you were a kid, because one of the poems in this book goes all the way back. It's called Super Bowl. It's on page 56, if you want to read that one for us.
Sure. This is sort of inspired by the fact that the Super Bowl has become such an enormous week on the calendar, sometimes 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl. When I was small and someone said the Super Bowl, I thought that it was some great dish that overflowed with stuff you bought, with stuff like candy, surely. Chocolate candy would be best, but lollipops are good as well, and certainly the rest of that great dish, that Super Bowl, would never carry pickles. Instead, between the chocolates, maybe there'd be dimes and nickels. Unhappily, we all grow up, and I grew up as well, and though I think the Super Bowl is sometimes kind of swell, I still recall the Super Bowl about which I would dream. And did I mention that it also featured peach ice cream? There's a big cartoon of a Super Bowl full of ice cream.
It looks delicious, by the way. What was the hardest rhyme in this book that you can remember putting together?
I'm not sure what the hardest rhyme in this book was, although I did ask readers to come up with a rhyme for golf.
And?
I couldn't come up with one myself, so I set up a poem in which they're invited to try to come up with a rhyme. And a friend of mine who was an older man football fan, he said Red Rolf would work, but I don't know if he was a good golfer.
And by the way, so people know, these are not all kind of fun and games and about ice cream. There are some that are a little more serious. If you want to pick one of those, Bill.
Yeah, there was one that I kind of had some fun with because of the way that our culture so glorifies athletes at an early age and tells, for example, a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy that he doesn't need to worry about doing anything in school because he's going to be a great basketball player and he'll make millions of dollars anyway. So I wrote one called Mom, I'm Going to Be a Star. Mom, I'm going to be a star. I love you, child, for what you are. But I will make $1 million, generating hoots and hollers. All the fans will shout my name. Maybe, child, and all the same, I will love you all my days, if you do or don't win praise. Mom, I'll build a house for you, and it will have an ocean view. That, my child, would be quite grand. Now sit with me and hold my hand, and know, in case you don't succeed, it's time for you to learn to read.
You know, but it does bring up a bigger issue that you have brought up before, which is that sports has become so much about money.
It's no question about it. It's much more expensive to go to a game than it used to be, and players make so much money that they are so thoroughly insulated from their public and even from the writers much more than they used to be. The entire shape of the sports world has changed a great deal.
Is there anything that could have been done to have that not happen?
I don't think so. I think we live in a culture where the generation of income is the measure of whether something is good. And so the natural progression in sports, like the natural progression in any business, has been to generate as much income as possible. And if more and more and more people are priced out of the opportunity to actually go see something, then that's the cost of doing business in this sort of state.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game and author of the new book of poetry called Take Me Out. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And Robin, were you able to come up with a rhyme for golf?
Rudolph, Adolf,
Rudolph,
Randolph.
Or I was thinking Zwolf, the German word for 12.
I was too.
I think that's what it is. Anyway, Here and Now is a production. You can write us, by the way. Let us know your rhymes for golf at hereandnow.org. We're a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, and Robin is smiling because I think she just came up with another one.
No, I'm just smiling.
this
it's
is here
and now.